I'd like to bring the Environment Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. Representative Hancock, do you want to move the minutes of March 18th?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read them. I do move the minutes of March 18th.
Discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Okay. Members, just one adjustment to the agenda. House File 1328, it's a bill I had. It deals with conservation easements. We're going to move it to the general register, but we're going to pull it from today's agenda. Just discussing, we don't know. There may be a technical amendment we may not need to do it. But rather than confuse people, we want to allow the correct posting. So we'll just delay it till next week. It's no big deal. So if you're here for 1328, it will not be on the agenda today. First, we'd like to hear Representative Dean, House File 1557. I'll move House File 15. Representative Fisher, do you want to move it? I don't know if you're...
I'd be happy to move House File 1557 if I'm correct for layover, correct?
Correct, yeah. Representative Fisher moves House File 1557. Representative Dean, welcome to the committee. We don't get to see you much in this committee, so must have some water issues out your way. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the time this morning. I realize how busy your schedule is, so I'll try to be as brief as I possibly can in what is a very simple but complicated problem in the Northeast Metro. Anybody who's been on White Bear Lake in the last 10 years has seen the lake drain. We've got a very big problem in White Bear Lake. Actually, the lake is down about 6 feet. It bounced back a little bit last year, but it's still way, way, way down. So it's a big deal for all of the property owners around White Bear Lake, but also people who don't necessarily live on the lake like me, whose kids would like to swim at the beaches that are closed because the lake doesn't have enough water in it. So it's about 1 billion gallons a foot. That's how much water we need. So if anyone has 5 billion gallons of water, I will take it, and I will put it in White Bear Lake. So there's been a lot of study about it and a lot of opinions about what is causing it. There was a USGS study that linked the depletion of that to the aquifer about 400 feet down. And my position, I've represented all of the areas around the lake, the cities around the lake, before and after redistricting different portions, and everyone realizes that there's a big problem. And I believe, and most of the people in the area, there's a common consensus that we're going to need a two-pronged solution of conservation and augmentation. Conservation has been pushed and has been looked at in the newspaper. You've probably seen connection to the St. Paul water system as a primary solution and response in hopes of recharging the aquifer. And I've been very, very unashamedly parochial about this. I really am looking at water in the lake, and for about more than half a century, it was pumped into the lake from 4 pumps around the lake itself. That is no longer legal, and since that time, there's been a very precipitous depletion of the water level since 2007. So I am looking for new sources of water for the lake. And we've looked at the possible change over to surface water with the Mississippi River, with one option that has been very public in the last year. I also want to look at augmentation through a pipe from the Mississippi River through Sucker Lake, as well as a regional wastewater treatment facility in the area. So then we'll have all three options on the table within the next year, so people can have a realistic look at what that costs. And once again, if people want to accuse me of being parochial about this, I will be 100% guilty as charged. And so if anyone wants to, whether it be the Met Council or the DNR, the MPCA, or anybody else wants to accuse me of that, I will walk away in shackles. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, that's my proposal. I really appreciate your time this morning and be happy to discuss that. It's a very complicated, big topic, but all I'm looking for is a couple of different options to look at in the next year, and so I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, thank you, Representative Dean, for bringing this forward. This is one of a variety of different proposals trying to address the water issues that we've got, not just around White Bear Lake, but also across the region. There have been a number of proposals that have been coming out, as Representative Dean was mentioning, to try and address going from groundwater to surface water to be more sustainable. But this proposal he has is one of the longer-term proposals that's looking at is how do we use water that's coming out of the ground and instead of sending it down to Mississippi and being treated and released there, is keeping it within that whole system. And so this is one of those great ideas that's out there, one of many that can help address it, because it's not going to be one solution that solves that problem going forward. It's going to take a combination of different solutions like this being linked together.
Thank you. Mr. Shetton, are you interested in testifying? If you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak on House File 1557. And I did have an opportunity to speak with Representative Dean last night, and I did express to him that we share the same concern about what is occurring with White Bear Lake, and we are also interested in finding a way to solve why the lake is losing so much water. We do have a couple concerns with the bill as it is proposed. Number one, there is a study being done by the USGS related to looking at the inputs and exfiltration and issues related to what is actually happening with the water in White Bear Lake. That study is expected to be complete by next summer. And I know that there is a concern by Representative Dean and Representative Fisher and other members from around that area that, you know, we're waiting too long to wait for that study. But we believe that if a feasibility study of this sort is going to happen, that we should have that information to allow us to figure out what is the proper way to fix White Bear Lake. And we are in accord with each other on that, because we all want the same result here to fix that. We are also a bit concerned about the portion of the bill that relates to the council having to take design or take proposals for design and construction of a wastewater facility. We have a wastewater facility in that area today, and if we were to construct another one in order to just augment White Bear Lake, we're not sure how we would pay for that. And so there is a potentially a cost to this as well. But I did share this with Representative Dean yesterday, and all I can say is, while we, again, agree that there is an issue there that needs to be addressed, we just have some concerns about the feasibility study, and we think that if this were to occur, that we should wait to get the USGS study later next summer. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions, but that is really the extent of where the council is in this bill.
Well, I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Shetman, but I will tell you the people in White Bear are sick of waiting. So I think we better look at some more options, and we appreciate you working on it, but kicking her down a little bit at this point is probably a doggone good idea.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Make
Mr.
comment.
Chair, Mr. Shetman. I agree with that. And one thing that we did look at, there was a Northeast Metro Area Water feasibility study that was conducted and actually completed last December. And specifically, this bill asks the council to look at augmentation from Sucker Lake, and one of the reasons that was actually excluded from the Northeast feasibility study, because there is apparently some water quality issues with Sucker Lake, and there's also some routing or pipe routing issues that were already looked at, and that's why it was excluded. But obviously the legislature can ask the council to do and I guess DNR, PFA, the Department of Health, to do whatever they would like, but we just have some concerns with that specific issue with Sucker Lake as well. But again, the bigger issue is what's happening with White Bear Lake, and we know that people are anxious to get moving on it, and so are we. So
thank you.
We want to be partners on this.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A clarifying question, Mr. Schnettman. You said next summer. Is the report coming in the summer of 2015 or the summer of 2016?
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the information that I have from our staff is that it will be available June of 2016.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, and maybe this is a question, I see Mr. Myers there. Is there any, I know we had the litigation and a settlement, what, is there any interplay between that agreement the previous study that was just completed, the study that's going to be that's ongoing, and then the bill. How would this all interact? That's kind of my question.
Mr. Shetton. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I will defer that to Bob from the DNR. Commissioner Meyer, do you want to, assuming you heard it, you were right there. Welcome, good morning. You could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and Representative Hansen, thank you for the question. We do share Representative Dean's, Representative Fisher's, and the community's concerns about the lake levels in White Bear Lake. As you know, we are in a mediated settlement kind of stay with a lawsuit that we're facing from the residents around White Bear Lake. Part of that mediated agreement is for us to introduce language, a bill, and get it passed actually by next year that would fund this phase one of a feasibility design study. And actually, there's a bill that will be introduced today in the Senate, and I've discussed this bill with Representative Dean, and I need to talk to Representative Fisher about getting it in the House. That is an agreement between all the parties in this settlement agreement that would seek funding to evaluate the long-term water supply in the Northeast Metro, identify options to address challenges. Basically, the options to be evaluated shall include Alternative 1B and Alternative 2B from the Met Council's report. It does not discuss augmentation, but we would be willing to include augmentation in this proposal. So the language that we have is what the groups have agreed to right now. That does not include the language that Representative Dean has at this point in time. The augmentation is something that was not included in the settlement agreement. We understand some people's desires to continue discussing that and are willing to include that in this phase one plan design option that is there. But this bill as drafted does not meet the requirements of that settlement agreement. And if we do nothing, or if this were to be done instead of that, we would be found in default of that agreement and back in court probably next year.
Representative Hornstein, to this point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you had mentioned the water supply situation. And I seem to recall, maybe it was even 8-10 years ago, Representative Garofalo had some legislation to require a study of water supply in the region. And I don't know if that's been updated since then. And is there anything in that study that would be helpful to this process?
Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I believe, I can't answer that. I think the Met Council is doing that study.
Right, that's correct. Yeah.
I would Mr. Shetland, do you have some light to shed on the study that Representative Hornstein's talking about?
Mr. Chair, members, I do. Representative Hornstein, what you're referring to is the Metro Area Water Supply Advisory Committee, which is made up of local officials throughout the metro area. There are some state agencies on there. And what we are looking at is really what are the water supply issues in the region moving forward. Just this last December, we created a technical advisory committee made up of additional local elected officials to really look at kind of what are the long-range issues related to the to water supply, but they weren't looking specifically at the issues that were happening in the White Bear Lake area.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a way that, you know, since we've got this group already up and running and in existence dealing with related issues, is there a way that they could be, since this is one of probably premier, most urgent water supply related questions in the region, is there a way that they could be engaged in this effort as well?
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, on a local level, through the Northeast Water Feasibility Study that we did, they were involved. The local officials from those areas were involved, and I think that that is maybe some of the issues that we're having with the folks in that area are kind of running out of patience because the issues with White Bear Lake continue to evolve, and the lake is losing water. And so that is why I think now the USGS is coming in and doing a deeper, broader look at maybe what is actually causing the problem with the water coming out of the lake. And that's what we're trying to figure out, that if you were to look at augmenting the lake, that may be a great way to solve this. But until we figure out why the water is draining out of the lake, we need to figure out how to put the plug in the lake so we can fill it up, rather than keep filling it up and have water keep coming out.
And so that is what hopefully we're going to be able to find out as part of this study that the USGS is doing. But I am by no means a water expert here, so I'm happy to follow up with the committee and have our staff follow up with any questions that you may have or the committee may have as well.
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
No, that helps.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Meyer, maybe, you know, folks are talking a lot about the different situation, and Representative Dean brings up the point about augmenting the lake. I think oftentimes people forget four huge pumps that were augmenting the lake for decades got turned off. Could you maybe just remind folks of the history? And sometimes that seems to be forgotten, and I think some people think that if we don't augment the lake, it's just going to fill itself back up, and history would tell us that may not be the case.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm not sure when those pumps were turned off, sometime in the 70s or early 80s, I believe, but the lake was augmented for quite some time. Representative Fisher, Representative Dean probably have more information on that than that, but the policy of the state was to stop augmenting surface waters with groundwater for those types of purposes. So it was based upon that for a long time. It is somewhat of a leaky system. From what I understand, the hydrology, the bottom of the lake is somewhat like a sponge, so to speak. It's not a solid clay bottom basin. So there are issues connecting surface water, groundwater, possibly. We are still waiting for the USGS to finalize those studies and then to come up with solutions off of that process. Mr. Chair, just on the bill itself, you know, it has the Commissioner of Natural Resources leading this study, and there's no funds appropriated. We are not the experts in constructing wastewater treatment facilities. We could talk about some of the biological issues related to augmentation, some of the hydrological issues, but constructing and installing and designing a wastewater facility is not the DNR's expertise. If this were to pass, we would need to contract that out or maybe work in conjunction with the Met Council or PFA or somebody like that. And also, I see there's no appropriation, so I'm not sure how this work would be funded, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Commissioner Meyer, the bill says in cooperation with the Commissioner of MPCA, and Health, and PFA, and if you want to also put in there Met Council, I get that. But you are the one that was in the lawsuit, so I think I know as much as you'd like that to go away, and you kind of got it on hold here a little bit, but you're kind of front and center on this issue, whether you like it or not. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that, and as I testified earlier, this language, if it were to pass, does not help us with that lawsuit at all. So it actually would probably cause more problems and answers for us with the litigants.
We're interested in, and we're only laying it, or we are laying it over to continue the discussion, but we will want to continue the discussion. Is it to this point, Representative Fisher? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at this, I think it would make sense that the Met Council be involved in this part because, number one, they're responsible for the sewage treatment system throughout the entire metropolitan area. And I think the other thing is that, from what I recall, up in the East Bethel area, they've been doing some unique things with treating the sanitary sewer water in that area to drinking water quality standards and releasing it. So they do have some experience in what may need to be doing there and are doing some innovative things. So I think it would be very important that we'd have some of that expertise and being involved in that process, because at some point they're going to have to be running part of that system.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to follow up a little bit on the question you asked a moment ago about the history of augmentation. Representative Dean, do we have any good information on how long an augmentation went on and how much water was pumped on an annual basis?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I can get you that information off the top of my head. I think it's the 20s to the 80s, was something like that. And I don't know the capacity for each of the four pumps around the lake of what they put out.
Representative Torkelson, I wonder if you want to direct it to Mr. Shetland. At least he's nodding no. Doesn't know. Okay. Representative Torkelson,
well,
go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is, you know, important information that helps, you know, some people have tried to bring White Bear Lake forward as kind of a canary in a coal mine situation, but this the need for augmentation obviously was there a long, long time ago, and they addressed it in a way that we find today to be inappropriate. But the truth is that White Bear Lake had lake-level issues back apparently to the 20s and required extensive augmentation to keep that level up. Any other comments, Representative Dean?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I can tell you that I grew up on a lake that was spring-fed. It was about 80 feet deep and spent my, you know, childhood swimming and water skiing in the lake. And you could tell when you were over a spring because it was cold. You know, you could feel the cold water. And I thought that that White Bear Lake is the same. And actually, after reading the studies that have been produced in the last couple of years, I find out that that's actually not the case. That the water comes into the lake from the surface to about 20 feet down, and it's a watershed that's basically only 1.5 to 1. So like a healthy watershed is about 7 to 1 from what I understand, so 7 acres of watershed for 1 acre of lake. This is about 1.5 to 1. So the water's coming into the lake from the top, and it's actually going into the aquifer, getting sucked out of the bottom. So that's what the USGS study is saying. So that actually if it was a bird bath situation, as the way it was described to me initially for 50 years, actually that's not such a dumb idea if the water is going back down into the aquifer. So you could look at the lake as a reservoir to recharge the aquifer, which would make more sense for recharge. And as I've been doing a little bit of kindergarten study of what they're doing in California, that would be the way they would describe it.
Representative Fisher, are you done, Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Torkelson a little bit, the DNR did a study on White Bear Lake in 1998 where they went into very much details how much the water that from augmentation stayed in the lake and how much went into the underlying aquifers, and got very detailed in those areas. And a few years ago, the USGS did a study looking at White Bear Lake, because over the years there's always been the issue of what's going on with White Bear Lake, because it does go up and down. But one of the things that the study from the USGS notified that it used to be that for the most part White Bear Lake always kind of followed what was happening with precipitation in the area, and it would go up and down. During the droughtful years of the 20s and 30s, when things went down from precipitation, the lake dropped dramatically. Same back in 87, same discussion came up, and it was turned out to be weather related. One of the things that the USGS noted in their most recent report as they were looking at it is that starting about 2003, the correlation between precipitation and the rain and the lake level in White Bear Lake started deviating. And so at that point in time, ever since then, it's been on a trend that does not tie together anymore. And where I see it as anecdotally is very evident is this past year. Last year, when we had the very heavy rains that caused every lake that was low in the area and throughout the region to go to above flood stage, except for White Bear Lake. White Bear Lake stayed 4 feet below. So there's something else that's going on up in that basin that is different than what used to happen historically. And that's why these studies are going on to try to find out what it is and try to figure out how do we fix that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another clarifying question for Commissioner Meyer. So based on the arbitrated settlement, were you correct in saying that we have to have a bill, or we have to have a law by next year, so we have to pass something this year? Did I hear that right?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Meyer.
Representative Hansen, I believe the first date is August of 2016 that funds have to be appropriated to complete this study, so that gives us one more session. It took us quite a while to get to an agreement of the language and exactly what that was going to entail with the plaintiffs. There's a lot of different issues out there, as you can imagine, so the timeline I can provide for the committee, the first deadline is August of 2016, at which time funds need to be appropriated for the study to be completed. And then the timeline is based on the completion of the study and funds appropriated for the build-out of this first phase of system, whatever that would be recommended. So,
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner Meyer, so the bill that's being introduced today in the Senate and then sometime in the House is a finance bill. It's got an appropriation with it.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Meyer.
Representative Hansen, yes, it's requesting $1.5 million. That would come to the DNR in conjunction with other stakeholders, including the Met Council, to begin this design and feasibility. Feasibility work and then some pre-design work as well. It's rather detailed in its description. I could read that to you if you'd be interested. But.
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, I'm just, this is deadline week, so I'm just, is this a, Mr. Chair, is this a bonding bill? Is it a design pre-design, or is this a, is it a general fund request, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Myers,
and at this point in time, it would be a general fund request. We recognize the deadline, the delay in the introduction probably does not allow it to be heard this year, but rather a piece of language that can sit out there for discussion and fine-tuning until it can get a hearing next year and be dealt with at that phase.
Representative Hanson, I'll remind you the deadlines we're under right now are for policy bills. And if this bill became a fiscal bill and it had fiscal costs, it could be incorporated into an omnibus, our financing bill, and it would be meeting deadlines. So if it becomes a fiscal bill, it certainly is something that could be incorporated in our omnibus spending bill. Representative Hanson.
So, Mr. Chair, if it got introduced today or Monday and gets on the calendar soon.
Representative Hanson, we're already hearing this 1557 today, so if this body decides to make it into a fiscal bill at a later date, it's already met appropriate deadlines and can be modified accordingly. Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, just
go ahead,
real quickly, the basis of the study, it says the study shall... The commissioner shall, in consultation and coordination with the affected communities, the Met Council, St. Paul Regional Water Services, industrial water permit holders, and other entities with a demonstrated interest in water supply challenges, prepare this report. Options to be evaluated include those within the Met Council's report. And we would complete a report summarizing the findings regarding long-term water supply sustainability challenges and the feasibility of various options for those challenges, which would be due to the legislature. In this draft, it would be by December 31st of 2016. So if it were delayed, it would delay it another year. So,
additional questions? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just for transparency, you could, if this bill was there, it could be a delete all amendment to the bill that we're hearing right now and be included in a finance bill.
I think, Representative Hanson, your point that it has a lot of similarities. It notes a couple different agencies, and I thought if Representative Fisher had made the point that maybe, I didn't know, Representative Fisher, if you wanted to modify this bill, that it is to clarify, Representative Dean's bill says health. I think it's meant to be the Department of Health, and Met Council's not noted. If you want, we could, staff has that amendment if you want her to read it the way you might like it and you could think about it. Ms. Taylor, do you want to read the changes you came up with based on Representative Fisher's comments?
Mr. Chair, members, I think the amendment would be on line 1.7 after the second comma, insert the Metropolitan Council, comma, and actually the health on line 1.7, that is correct. It's, if you look at line 1.6, it's the commissioners of the Pollution Control Agency and Health, and we typically refer to the Commissioner of Health as the Commissioner of Health, not the Commissioner of the Department of Health. So that would be correct. So you just need to add the Metropolitan Council.
Representative Fisher, do you want to move that oral amendment as stated by Ms. Taylor?
Yes, sir. I'd like to move that.
Discussion to the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. That amendment's adopted. Representative Dean, I don't see any other question. Representative Fisher, you want to renew your motion?
Yes, sir. I'd like to renew motion to have 1557 as amended laid over for inclusion, possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Your bill is laid over for possible inclusion and sounds like maybe possible amendment. Thank you for coming forward. We appreciate it. Next, Commissioner Meyer, you might as well stay right there. I'd like to move House File 1329 to be passed and moved on to the General Register. Commissioner Meyer, this is a DNR policy bill, if I remember right. And members, we do have a A6 amendment. I'd like to move the A6 amendment to get it in the shape Mr. Meyer would present then. What it does is it deletes on page 11, it deletes section 26, which is in the game and fish bill, so that's not needed. And then it also deletes section 53, which will need to go into our budget bill because it has fiscal impact. This bill is going on to the general register, so it would be appropriate that it not have fiscal impact. And so, members, that's what the A6 does. Is there any discussion to the A6? Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, there's one other oral amendment that was missed in its last committee. I don't know if we can address that.
Mr. Right Meyer, now. Why don't you state the oral amendment, and then we'll have Ms. Taylor confirm what its implications are, and we will.
Lines.
You know what? Time out.
Okay.
Commissioner Meyer, let's keep the A6 the way it is and do the oral amendment separately. Discussion of the A6. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Okay, the A6 is adopted. Commissioner Meyer, state your oral suggestion.
On lines 5.21, Mr. Chairman, after the word the, insert unpaved shoulder of the. So that sentence would read extreme right-hand side of the unpaved shoulder of the road. Was language that we discussed with Representative Hackbarth when we were working on this amendment that was not included.
Representative Dill, does that make sense to you? Do you want to move that oral amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That does make sense. We did talk about it, and there was actually a pretty good discussion on it. I'll move the amendment.
Okay, and Commissioner Meyer, will you restate, Representative Hackbarth, we're on page 5 of House File 1329. Line 5.21. Representative Hackbarth, after the first, or the only the, after the, Representative Dill has moved to incorporate the words unpaved shoulder of the.
I was just out in the hall trying to...
Representative Hackbarth.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I was just out in the hallway trying to talk to Ray Bone.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth, we're going to lay this oral amendment over while DNR walks through the bill, and we will come back to the oral amendment.
All right.
So we'll assume everything's okay. Representative Dill, do you mind withdrawing your oral amendment temporarily?
No, that's fine, Mr. Chairman. This is language that we talked about, and maybe there's new information that since the committee, or since the Hackbarth committee, so thank you.
Thank you. Chair Hackbarth will discuss with the interest groups to be sure that we're on the right page on this ATV amendment. It was discussed in Chairman Hackbarth's committee. Commissioner Meyer, why don't you walk through the bill as it is now after the A6 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner. This is the DNR policy technical bill. The first couple sections, Section 1, Section 2, Section 3, Section 3 was added in committee. So Section 1 and 2 deal with who has to sell the title, who needs to transfer the title when you sell an off-highway motorcycle rather than the seller having to buy it. We're putting the onus on the purchaser. You can see on line 1.29. Section 2 deals with that same language. It says the purchaser is subject to penalties if they don't transfer that. Section 3 actually is language that was added in Representative Hackbarth's committee that states that if an application, if approved, commissioner must review an off-road vehicle grant and aid application. If approved, commencement review of it within 60 days. If the commissioner fails to approve or deny the application within 60 days after submission, the application is deemed approved. This is similar to issues that we face with other applications. We've talked about it with Representative Fabian's House File 1 several years ago. But if a non-complete application comes in, we're just going to say no to it. I mean, with the 60-day deadline, this was not our language. We can support some phase of that, but we have some concerns with that language as it's written. It could just lead us to say no faster if there's not a complete application. Section 4 deals with the snowmobile transfer, as we talked about with the other pieces there. Sections 5, 6, and 7 came about from the ATV working group that we had. That included Polaris, Articat, ATVAM, other manufacturers and stakeholders talking about the definitions of ATVs. We changed them last year. This is a tweak clarifying what they say and how they operate. Basically, we're going from a weight to a width. So you can see a class 1 is an ATV has to be less than 2,000 pounds, And then there's the class ones and the class twos. The class ones are the smaller ones. Traditionally, they were a straddle seat. Now they have small with small ATVs with steering wheels and roll cages. So we're trying to go to the size of the machine rather than the handlebars versus steering wheel. So class one now will be width of 50 inches or less, and class two is from 50 to 65, and all ATVs have to be 2,000 pounds or less and 65 inches or less. Our trail system is set up that way, and that's the way we're looking to classify them. It simplifies everything. Section 8 deals with that transfer again on snowmobiles. Section 9 is an amendment that was added on in Representative Hagbarth's committee from the ATV Association that would allow the language is actually on 5.4. A person from 12 to 16 with an altering vehicle safety certificate may operate on the roadway if they have that ATV certificate and they're accompanied by their parent or legal guardian. And then you can actually see the language, what they're talking about allowing a person to do on page 6. Yeah. Says that the city or county, through its governing body, may by ordinance allow a person to operate an ATV on a road or street to get to a residence, business, and make trail connections. The discussion was that if a family is out riding, trail riding, and you have your child or the 12 to 16-year-old who's been trained and is riding with you on a machine and you want to pull into town to get something to eat or get some supplies or even to get gas, I suppose, right now that's not legal. So that person, that child, would have to technically probably leave that machine on the trail corridor since they could not drive there legally. Now we're changing that, making it so they can get into town to get gas, go to the local businesses, things like that. Section 10, the language that we were talking about amending, also allows from 517 to 519 these Class 1 ATVs now that previously were a Class 2. I'm probably confusing everybody about this. But so the Class 1 machines that were a Class 2 with the steering wheel and a roll cage would not be able to, without this language, drive on that shoulder of the road in like a Class 2 can in the ditch and things like that. So this saying is a Class 2 ATV with a steering wheel and a roll cage that's designed for an operator and a passenger with seat belts can operate in those same places that the Class 2s could operate previously, if that makes sense. Does anybody have any questions on that? I think I've confused everybody substantially enough. But
Commissioner Meyer, what you're talking about is the traditional small single-seat ATV that people think of with handlebars. Some of them now are being equipped with a steering wheel instead of handlebars, and they're protected with roll cages. And the historic way we defined ATVs called them a Class 2, even though they performed like the traditional Class 1. So you're modifying the description to more adapt to the width of a machine as opposed to how the handlebar or steering wheel is configured. Does anyone have any questions in regards to that? I think we've got... Oh, Representative Fabian, you don't understand the difference between Class 1 and Class 2?
No, I just... For clarification, Mr. Chair, they do make them the Class 1 and the side-by-side as well so that they do have the passenger. Okay, they are narrow enough so that they do have the passenger.
Mr. Chair.
He beat me on that one,
Representative Fabian. That was the gist of this language. So the Class 1, they're making these side-by-side ATVs smaller now that fit within the 50-inch frame. So that's exactly what we're trying to do is have this Class 1 that used to be considered a Class 2 be able to still ride where the Class 2 could ride. There were some people who bought these machines, got caught up in this change, and we were not enforcing the law that way after the change last year, but telling people this is coming. So we want to make sure that people who bought a machine to ride in a certain spot can still do that. And that's what this language does.
Okay, Commissioner Meyer, I've got to acknowledge now I am confused. So does the small side-by-side go on which trail? And I don't know if my question is for you or it's for you, not Representative Fabian, because he already went up me once. I don't want him to do it twice.
Mr. Chairman.
I know my ATVs.
A machine that has a steering wheel and a roll cage that is less than 50 inches or less is now considered a Class 1 ATV.
If it has two seats on it, is it still a Class 1 if it's under
it's
the...
It's 50 inches or less, correct.
Thank you. And for the record, Representative Fabian is from northern Minnesota where they make Rosal, from Rosal where they make ATVs at Polaris and Arctic Cat are both in your district, right? Representative Fabian.
That's right, Mr. Chair, Thief River Falls.
Thank you. Thief River Falls. So I don't even have his district, right? So I'm really losing. Commissioner Meyer, continue.
There's a, so that brings me to Section 11 on page 6, 6.32. There's a series of sections that we're performing a technical change on the way that we designate invasive species or invasive waters and a bunch of things like that. Rather than listing, we're changing it to designate. So Section 11, 12, 13, 14 deal with that designation change. Section 15 is a clarification on bait harvested from waters, which conforms with that section. Section 16, again, listed the designated. Section 17 now is we're clarifying in invasive species in 84D that the DNR has the authority, the conservation officer or other licensed peace officer, this would be a county under a delegated agreement with the DNR, that we can order the person, order the removal of aquatic macrophytes, so zebra mussels and plants and things like that, and also include order a person to decontaminate their boat using hot water or high-pressure equipment when available on site before it's transported. This includes water-related equipment such as a dock or a boat lift. The next section of this statute...
Commissioner Meyer, Representative Uglem has a question. Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Meyer, going back to Section 15, Subdivision 3, the bait harvest from infested waters, next line says, taking wild animals from infested waters for bait or aquatic farm purposes. Could you define what you're talking about with wild animals?
Representative Uglem, can you direct us to page and line?
Page 7, Section 15, Subdivision 3. Line 714-715.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, well, that's current law, and what we're changing is that the taking, the waters are listed, except those listed as infested with prohibited species, and then in streams or rivers that are listed as infested, except those listed with certifiable diseases of fish. I could bring down staff to talk. I don't know what the wild animals would be referring to there. I'm sure it's just a definition that the definition of wild animals includes things from these lakes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglem.
Yes, Mr. Meyer, that was my question.
Mr. I think it
why don't we bring them
mussels? I mean, I could bring Ann Pierce down, Mr. Chair.
Please do. If you could identify yourself for the record, and it looked like you heard the question. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Ann Pierce. I'm a section manager with the Division of Ecological and Water Resources for the DNR. And wild animals in this case refers to mussels and things like that within the...
Thank you. Representative Uglem.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, with that... Wild animals also include, like, if you were trapping beaver or muskrat or anything like that?
Manager Pierce.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, it would.
Representative Uglem.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming down. Continue, Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. So we left off on lines 9.22 talking about the decontamination and our ability action for clarifying our authority to order a person to decontaminate their boat. So lines 9.22 to 9.27 basically says that we can order you to decontaminate your boat when the equipment is available on site. We have hot water pressure washers, and we've redesigned boat launching facilities to have space for these areas, and sometimes we have our roadside checks where we have decontamination equipment available. And a lot of counties are working towards that as well to provide decontamination and inspection services at their boat launches. So we're clarifying that we can order for the removal of prohibited species with the decontamination equipment, or if that equipment's not available, you can see on line 9.25, we may include tagging the water-related equipment and issuing a notice that specifies a time frame for completing the removal or decontamination and reinspection of the water-related equipment. So what we're seeking authority to do is if you pull up, we're at the boat launch, you pull up and there's no decontamination equipment available, we would put a tag on your boat, on the eye of the boat. Other states do this, and I think we have some examples, and issue you a piece of paper saying you need to decontaminate your boat by 2 weeks, 15 days, 30 days, whatever that will be, and here's where you can do it, you know, depending on where they're going. If they're coming out of Gull Lake and going back home, give them some locations where they could do it in the cities and how to get that boat certified that it's clean, and then have to tell them how to complete that removal or decontamination and get reinspected.
Thank you. Commissioner Meyer, I do want to, you and I had a discussion yesterday. So if, and it might need a call a friend. So if you're taking your boat out of the lake and it's one of the infested lakes and maybe it's a pontoon that sits on the surface, not on a lip, so it's got some zebra mussel, and you're taking it out of your lift and you may be bringing it around to your own garage or to your neighbor's garage where it's going to sit until next spring, and then, or maybe next spring you'll sell it and it'll go to a different lake. Do we have a process where that landowner or boat owner won't be breaking the law when they pull away from the ramp? That's my concern.
Mr. Chair, members, as we had discussed yesterday, if you're going from on your own property, pulling your boat out to store on your shoreline or your dock to stay there, that is legal without any work right now. And I'm going to bring Ann down probably, and maybe Rodman if I need to discuss this. I believe that there is some documentation that we have to allow a person to transport those, to do what you're saying. If you're pulling out of your lake to go to a storage facility and go back to your lake is one situation. If you're pulling out to sell, I know water-related equipment needs to be dried under law for 21 days, I think, right now, correct?
Manager Pierce, my question is, so if you're taking your boat out of a lake and it's got, let's just use, say, zebra mussel, for instance, on the boat, and it's going maybe to be stored off-site, a lot of people store at different storage facilities off the lake, do they need some documentation that they're going there and it's going to sit there till next spring? And then what about when they move from there, maybe to go take it out for a ride on another lake and it's been there all winter? What do they need to do so they're not breaking the law?
Mr. Chair, members, and Rodman might have to come down and help with this also, but there's a couple of things. If they're storing it on their property without transporting it for storage, they can store it on their property, put it back in the lake. If they're transporting it, they can get basically a permit to transport it to that one location to get it decontaminated. Transporting it back, my understanding, I think Rodman will have to correct me, is that they would have to have cleaned it.
Okay, but, and Colonel, my question would be, so you take it up from the landing and you're going to somebody that you've paid space for to store in their pole shed, and it's got some zebra mussel on it, but you're pulling it out in October and it's not going back in the water until May. The zebra mussels are all dead. Do we still require them to power wash their boat? Colonel Smith, if you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
For the record, Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair, to answer your question, riparian landowners can take their boat out of the water, store it for the season, put it back in. And what we've done is riparian landowners that aren't pulling it directly onto their shore, but they're going to a public access, then going back down to their place of residence to store the boat, we've also included that as riparian because they have to go to public access to get those off. But when people are pulling their boats out of water and bringing them off-site, some of these storage places are 10, 15, 20 miles away, and they do end up selling the boat over the year, we do require them to get all those zebra mussels off before they put them back in the water.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Yes. I appreciate it. Commissioner Meyer, you can continue.
Mr. Chairman, members, so If there are no other questions on that, we'll continue moving on. Section 18 just is related to that, concerning decontamination into those issues to be able to issue a permit for that. Section 19-20 deal with that changing of listing to designate. Section 21 is expanding the use of our invasive species account funds to also include habitat improvements. One of the things that we've discussed in the past is the cleaner the water, the less likely invasive species are to take hold. Or if we can propagate healthy native plants, those non-native invasive plants will have less of an opportunity to take over a lake. So we're looking to allow, where applicable, to do habitat improvements with those dollars. Section 22 is language that was brought to the chairman by the Parks and Trails Council that we support, that just clarifies that trails designated in Chapter 85 may include connections to state park or rec areas that lie in between that corridor, so we don't have to come back to the legislature and ask for authority to go into a park or a rec area. It seems to make sense. Section 23 actually is a section from Representative Lewick that we asked him to work with us on that clarifies that the Camp Ripley Trail that was established several years ago in going through the master plan design, this is established as a motorized and a non-motorized trail. There's certain parts of the corridor that we want to be able to separate those two trail corridors rather than keep them together. So you'll just see the language on 11.3 that says separation of motorized and non-motorized corridors is acceptable as needed. The constituents and the stakeholders all agree with that language. Section 24 is language that clarifies that the mine hoist at Lake Vermilion Sedan Underground State Park is regulated under federal mine hoist code rather than Department of Labor and Industry elevator code. Department of Labor and Industry and our attorneys have worked through this language. We're in support of it. Elevator code requires doors and buttons and things like that. Mine hoists are designed for mining and hauling people, so we feel that this language is appropriate. Just clarifies how that facility is inspected going forward.
Commissioner Meyer, you wouldn't get the experience you get today going down in that shaft if you couldn't see the sidewalls of the stone as you go down. So I think it's a common sense part of the bill. Representative Dill could probably confirm that experience. It's pretty unique and cool. Representative Dill.
A long way down there.
A long, long, long way down. Commissioner Meyer, continue.
Chairman, Section 25 just relates to that same facility, clarifying that the state park permit is not needed to go down to the Stunts Bay Boathouse area, which is just down the same road over the hill. So that we're just clarifying that. Section 27 is another technical clarification on the fire code that we use. Rather than refer to Minnesota Technical College System document, we're referring to a National Fire Protection Association document. That next section is related to that. The next 10 pages, section 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, and 46 and 47 deal with the auxiliary forest statutes that are in Chapter 88. What this was, it was a program established back in the 50s, I believe, where a large landowner could register their forest as an auxiliary forest. Your property taxes go down to 10 cents an acre, and then you pay a yield tax when you harvest the timber to the county. We have four of these contracts still going on right now. What the language is doing, it's repealing the ability to get into the program, changing all of those things that are necessary, removing everything that's necessary so the program is no longer enrollable, but it keeps the language intact that we need for these four contracts to continue going until 2027, the last one expires. So the other sections are repealed. We would like to repeal the whole section, but in consultation with our attorneys, these are the recommended changes that came up with to allow those four enrollees to continue moving.
Commissioner Meyer, I just want to confirm, some members in the audience may be here for this section. Is there anyone that wants to speak in opposition to these sections being in the bill? Okay, I don't see anybody wanting to come forward. Representative Dill, Representative Hancock, these sections are okay from the northern Minnesota folks. Mm-hmm. Representative Dill?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Continue, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Section 48 is a clarification that our forest bow account, that we can use some of those funds for special forest product information and education programs like birch bark harvesting and things like that, so people can understand how that's working. Section 49 is a change to the language that we passed last year dealing with once through cooling water use permits. And what we're asking for is to insert language that would allow us to issue a permit for a system in existence prior to the law being enacted for systems less than 5 gallons or up to 5 million gallons per year.
Commissioner Meyer, and to confirm again, this is once through systems. It does not allow them to take groundwater and put it on the surface. It's groundwater that's going back in the ground.
Mr. Chairman, questions
in regards to this. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, I did have a couple of questions from a couple of earlier sections that I didn't respond quickly enough to.
Sure, go ahead. Representative Hausman.
The first one was on page 5, that a person 12 years of age, we've added roadway. And when I read from the previous committee that Representative Russo raised the question about that, and was assured by Representative Anzelf that was just intended for a 12-year-old to be able to ride a couple of blocks to go to get a hamburger. But the language seems so very broad. How does addition of roadway limit that to just going a couple of blocks to get a hamburger for a 12-year-old?
Mr. Meyer.
Chairman, Representative Hausman, this was an amendment that was brought forward in the committee by Representative Hackbarth, that the intention was that it was testified to that the language would allow that person to be on the roadway bank or slope if they have those things there. Then I think, as I mentioned, if the new language would allow them, I think what Representative Ansells was probably referring to was the language on 6.29 to 6.31, where a city, county, city, or town may by ordinance allow a person to operate an all-terrain vehicle on a public road or street to access businesses and residences and to make trail connection.
And Mr. Chair, I see that language, but I don't see how we are limiting by adding that roadway. We're not saying you just go a couple blocks in the city to get a hamburger. You're adding roadway.
I think your observation, road. Representative Hausman, is correct. And Representative Fabian would tell you that in Roseau and Thief River Falls, they want the people to be able to ride around if the community allows it okay. Representative Hausman, you and I live in a different world than they do up there. Representative Hausman.
The second one was on Section 25. You said the boathouse doesn't require a state park permit. Can you give us the reason why?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Meyer, I'm sorry. To not confuse things, Representative Hausman, Representative Dill had a question on your first one to your first point. Okay. To Representative Hausman's point, Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we did work on some language outside originally when I proposed the amendment. Whenever you'd like to take that up since we were on that section, but I'd like to comment on the Stunts Bay boathouses. The reason that is not requiring a park permit is, first off, those are historic boathouses. They're on school trust land that you need to go through the park to access them. But those are privately owned and maintained boathouses, and it just is a coincidence that you have to go through the state park to get to the place where people who live remotely, like I do out on the lake, to get to where their boats are stored in those historic boathouses. And that's the reason for the, at least unless you have further information, that's the reason for not having to have a park permit to do that.
Representative Hausman, we're going back to your original issue, and if you can point us to the line, and is it the same one that Representative Hackbarth, Representative Dill were working on? Representative Hausman.
On page 5-4, we add roadway, but what he just referenced was 6-29-30-31, which has much more descriptive language, but I don't see how we limit in any way.
Mr.
Commissioner
Chairman,
Meyer.
Representative Hausman, I think the key piece on here, if you look at the next section here, 5.29 to 5.31, which is current law, that states that a road authority may, after a public hearing, restrict the use of all-terrain vehicles in the public road right-of-way under its jurisdiction. So this isn't carte blanche. It's done on a case, I mean, a county by county, city by city. Any local road authority can control these things and allow them or disallow them. So the language up above, the way I understand it, would allow them if the local road authority thinks it's okay.
And then
Representative
my third,
Hausman.
Third question is the one we're on right now, Section 49.
Representative Hausman, if you don't mind, so we don't get totally confused, there's some folks that have questions to your first point. Is it okay if we take those so that, and it's, is it Representative Cornish?
ATV issue?
It's the issue of the 12 to 16 year olds riding on the road specifically.
Well, just a comment that I wish it was statewide and opened up in, just to give you an example, in our communities, the ATV riding is extremely popular for businesses too. And I went to both Waseca and Blue Earth County and got them to use this ordinances, and they opened up all roads, all gravel and all tar roads in both counties for travel. And since then, the businesses have been very thankful. We haven't had any accidents or things happen, and for commerce, it's been really great to be able to get into town, and the towns are making routes through, so it's been a very successful program. So,
thank you. Now, Representative Hausman, you can continue on to your next point.
The one we're on right now, Section 49, Mr. Chair, whenever you see something like issue a water permit that existed prior to January 1, 2015 for up to 5 million gallons, that always sounds like one particular thing that we're kind of carving out. Did one issue happen? When it's that specific, you always wonder about.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner Meyer.
Members, actually, this was something that was in a report that we presented to the legislature, and Representative Fisher was working with us on last year. So the one cooling that we were concerned about would be called, some call it a pump and dump, where you're pumping groundwater and releasing it to the surface water for cooling purposes, for example. There's one in existence yet that's allowed by statute. But what we want to do is we want to be able to issue a permit for somebody that we may not know exists for, if you go at the top of the next page, we're talking about may issue once through system water use permits on an annual basis for groundwater thermal exchange devices or aquifer storage and recovery systems that return all once through cooling water to the aquifer. So we don't want to, we're trying to correct the situation that we may have outlawed something that may be a good thing that we don't know about. You may have one of these systems that has not been permitted yet, and you've had it for several years. We wanted to allow us to issue a permit, and then the next section says that we can waive the fees for past unpermitted appropriations for these systems as well. So it's the once-through cooling that we were concerned about was this groundwater use, where people were pumping groundwater, using it for thermal exchange, and discharging it to a surface water. That is against the law now. It was prohibited statewide as of January 1st, 2015, with a statute that passed last year.
And so, Mr. Chair, just to clarify.
Representative Hausman.
So we're not talking about one particular place that you can pinpoint that you know is happening right now?
Madam Chair, no.
You're just doing it as a precaution?
Yes.
Commissioner Meyer, and you don't know exactly, but I thought the discussion was maybe less than 100, or am I wrong on that? I thought do we not even have a clue?
Mr. Chairman, we think it could be less than 100, but we don't want to get into a situation in July or November where somebody says they have one of these things, look, I'm sorry, I didn't know I needed a permit, and then the language that was actually passed was so prescriptive it wouldn't allow us to permit that. So that these are homeowner heating and cooling systems, geothermal type systems.
It's the geothermal, or people are using the temperature of the water down deep to heat or cool their home.
Yes.
Generally speaking, we think of them very environmentally friendly, but we want to make sure we know what's going on and who has them. Representative Clark.
Just to this point, Mr. Chairman, but didn't you say there is one system right now that needs this? And where is that?
Commissioner Meyer.
Chairman, I believe it's the Fuller Brush Company over in, is that Representative Fisher's district?
Representative Fisher, you know
thank
the answer?
Mr. Chair. No, it's not. It's just to the east. I think it might be in 42A, which would be represented by Isaacson's.
Commissioner Meyer.
That was the situation that was specifically allowed by law until that equipment is no longer available. That was done back in the 90s.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
And we're not concerned about that. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Mr. Chairman, it's still operating in compliance, and we're fine with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Ms. Taylor has the I think our concern on this is once through cooling, I think, was prohibited in the 89 Groundwater Act. And if we're if we're making the change for new technology, and I think you're close to it, but maybe it's maybe we need to say what we mean here, that this is for, I know later in the in that section we talk about the thermal, but I'm worried that the 26, 29, 26, 30, 31 opens up the door to something that hadn't, that had been prohibited, and may, people may have installed, not the geothermal, that's not what I'm, but so I wonder if Ms. Taylor, if my memory is right, or just the legislative history on the prohibition on one side.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, I did have a chance to quickly look, and the original act did prohibit once-through cooling, but it was in excess of 5 million gallons.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, yes, and you can actually see that in the existing language in 2.26 and 2.29. So all once-through cooling system use permits in excess of 5 million gallons annually must be terminated by the commissioner unless they discharge into a nature preserve. This is the one situation. That's how they did that. And now we're saying that we may issue a permit for systems in existence after the law passed for systems 5 million gallons or less. Then we get into the new language on the top of the next page. So we're trying to clarify and deal with these systems that are out there that are what I'll call environmentally friendly or groundwater friendly. The other ones would not be allowed anymore.
Representative Hansen.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to get this on the record as it's somewhat confusing here. So when we're, I want to make sure that we're not undoing really old law, and when we've got the up to 5 million annually geothermal, we want to make sure that we're encouraging that type of stuff, but we just want to make sure we're not opening that up to something that is settled a long time ago. So,
Mr. Chairman, that's not what this
Commissioner Meyer
does.
And Representative Hansen, I had the same discussion with Commissioner Meyer, wondering and trying to understand it. And I think it's good to get it on the record where we're at. Representative Fabian. Oh, okay. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just thinking about what Representative Cornish said, and I think I really understand what he's talking about. It sounds like he did that extra step of talking to a county, actually did that. So I'm wondering if, because when people are reading the law, they may not refer back to the part that's on 6.29. I'm wondering if there'd be a way to, in the law, say, you know, yeah, I am 6.29. I wonder if there's a way just to reference that so the person who's reading the law about the 12 or 15-year-old knows that a city or county can has jurisdiction there to decide. So similar to what Representative Cornish was talking about, that they're okay with it. So that is, you know, that's my point. I don't know, maybe the council can help us with that, how that language would be put together.
Well, and Representative Clark, I think generally speaking, you have some responsibility as riders to know when you're riding in communities, you should know if they're ones that allow you to go on the roadway or not. Generally speaking, I think for the most part, Representative Hackbarth, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but people when they're riding down the trail, they know which communities and counties are welcoming into those communities, and it's their responsibility to know the law. Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that's correct. When you're riding in these communities, ATV riders don't want to be ticketed. If they're going to be riding on the road in a community where they're not supposed to be, they're going to get a ticket. They don't want to get tickets, so they want to abide by the law. They're not going to be riding through town when they're not supposed to be. Most of these riders, like in Isle, Minnesota, for example, they passed an ordinance to allow this to happen, and it happens in a lot of communities, like with Representative Cornish's counties. It's already in the law that gives them the authority to do it or not to do it if they don't want to do it.
And Representative Hackbarth, if I remember right, don't they even on these trails tend to have a little feel for Johnny's barbecue head this way with your ATV welcome and open for business?
Absolutely correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Dill to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could go through a number of communities in the north that the trail comes into the outside of the community, which is not in a town, and there's a connection, a few blocks, a mile, 2 miles, where they need to get from the trail that's an ATV trail designated trail. I'll use Silver Bay or Babbitt as an or Silver Bay as an example. Silver Bay is a hub of ATV activity for people from the middle of this state or from this state that come up there every weekend. They have to be able to get from the trail to the town to go to their motels, to go to... Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's a block. In some instances, it could be numerous miles, but there has to be a mechanism to allow them to transverse from one situation to another situation. And frankly, in the north, many, many cities are just opening it up so that you can... Babbitt, for an example, has now citywide, Silver Bay, citywide use of ATVs by every single person that is legal to operate an ATV. And so I'm not sensing, at least in our part of the area, that there's abuse of this and that it's something that's needed. And a clarification specific.
Members, I do have both Clark and Hansen to this point. We do have a Representative Torkelson bill that we need to do today, and we are going to do it today. And I don't even really want to tell you, but we have the room reserved for after session. So if you've got good points to make, I appreciate and will certainly let them be made. But I think if we could be done with this bill in about 10 minutes, it would give us time to do Representative Torkelson's bill without having to come back tonight. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I support what Representative Hackbarth and Representative Dill are saying. That's not my point. We're changing the law, and I'm just talking about how we could make it clear. So we're not requiring an update on the signs. So if we're not doing that, at least we could allow the people who are going to be using the law to know what is required in their city or county. And that's all my point is. I think there's a way to do that by referencing back, and I would ask our council to do that. We don't have to do it today, but I think it's important that people know that when we change the law here, that they'll know in some ways, but not everybody's going to know.
Okay. And Ms. Taylor, why don't you take notation of Representative Clark's concerns, work with Mr. Meyer, and see if we can come up with something. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I have two small towns in my district, Mendota and Lilydale, so... The question is, so let's say the city of Mendota passes a resolution. So would that be applicable in the metro area, like in my district with Mendota? If they pass a resolution, they could take an ATV on the city streets and on Highway 13 that goes.
Mr. Chairman, they would have to hold
Mr.
a
Meyer.
Public meeting and then pass has something in affirmative, and it would only be applicable to the roadways under their authority. So. That each local road authority would have to deal with that separately. So County Road 13 would be MnDOT, and they would not probably allow that to happen.
And Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, there, I want to be clear that the ATVs do not include, maybe for lack of a better term, like senior scooters. We actually have issues in some of our cities with people on the roadways driving scooters like which we have in the trails here. So I want to make sure that the ATV does not include vehicles like that.
No, that's on the record. We know that. Mr. Meyer, if you want to answer that and then move on to the rest of the bill.
In the bill, it says the ATV does not include golf cart, mini truck, dune buggy, go-kart, or vehicle designed to use specifically for long maintenance, agriculture, logging, or mining purposes. So I think we're pretty much covered there. I do want to remind you, Mr. Chairman, that I think Representative Dill had an oral amendment to this section.
Yeah, through this section. Representative Dill, you want to move your oral amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like Ms. Taylor to read the oral amendment, and it is different than the first oral amendment that we talked about slightly.
You've worked with Ms. Taylor. She's ready. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would be on line 5.20. After the second the, which is at the end of the sentence, or end of the line there, insert right shoulder or the. So it would read County Highway on the right shoulder or the extreme right-hand side, etc.
Does everybody have the amendment? Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Okay, that amendment, the oral amendment's adopted. Mr. Meyer, why don't you just walk through the rest of the
Chair, we
pretty
have
well non-controversial.
That I think we could run through here relatively quickly. We left off on Section 51. It's just a clarification to the title examination for use under statutes 2014. Section 52 allows us to transition these registrations on ATVs so that everybody doesn't have to come back in and re-register. When your registration expires in the next year or two or three, you just will change your registration if need be from a Class 1 to Class 2 at that time. Saves us a ton of money. Section 53, I believe, was removed in the author's amendment. Section 4 is a revisor's instruction. Section 55 is repealing sections related to the auxiliary force that's listed in the back of the bill.
Commissioner Meyer, did you walk through the repealers? You didn't, did you?
They're just all they're in the bill. They relate to the auxiliary force pieces that we do not no longer need anymore.
Thank you.
So they're all listed there.
Okay. Discussion to the bill? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, on page 27 at the bottom where we've got the registration transition going on, it talks about until the electronic system has been upgraded to conform. How long is that going to take, Mr.
Commissioner
Chair,
Meyer?
We're in the process of doing that right now. I think it'll be rolling out here in the next quarter or two, probably.
Seeing no other discussion, anybody in the audience wants to speak to any sections in the bill? Anyone in the audience to speak to any sections of the bill? I renew my motion that House File 1329 be sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. That bill's adopted. Commissioner Meyer, thank you. Representative Torkelson. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1931. I'm not sure of the... that it be passed and moved to taxes.
Representative Torkelson, it's going to taxes, yes. All so right. Your motion is to move House File 1931 be passed and moved on to taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize we're nearing the end of our time for the day, but I think we can get through this. House File 1931 deals with two programs. One, the Sustainable Forest Initiative Act that's been around for a while, but has had some... quite a bit of talk about the program lately, and there's some issues that need to be adjusted and tuned up in the statutes, and that's the effort that's going to be made with this bill. The other program involved in this bill is the Aquatic Invasive Species Aid Program that was newly initiated last year in last year's tax bill that sent $4.5 million actually in the first payment to the counties of Minnesota based on the number of boat landings and parking places in those boat landings that they have. And there's clarification as to how that program actually, the mechanics of it are going to work. There's been some issues that have come up in the interim that need to be addressed. And I would like to turn the discussion over to Mr. Cummings, who is here with the details of the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Cummings. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair Fabian. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The provisions in this bill are related to the environment that we're traveling in the Department of Revenue's policy and technical bills. Thank you to Representative Torkelson for agreeing to carry these provisions, and thank you to you, Mr. Chair, for agreeing to hear the bill. First, let me state that these are policy updates, corrections, or technical provisions related to the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act and the Aquatic Invasive Species Aid Program. There may be other proposals to expand the scope of these programs or to eliminate these programs. While the Department of Revenue would certainly like to be engaged in those discussions, this bill is doing neither of those. These are updates to existing law and how to ensure these programs work as well as possible. Let me briefly go over the provisions of the bill, Mr. Chair. Section 1 amends statute to provide that forest management plans required under SFIA must be registered with the DNR. Currently, they are required to be created but not registered. This proposal aligns with the Office of Legislative Auditor's recommendations related to the program, and this would be effective for certifications after July 1st of 16. This bill also adds the requirement that if land is enrolled in the Reinvest in Minnesota program, certain state and federal easement programs, the Agricultural Preserves program, or the Green Acres program, the entire parcel that contains those acres cannot be enrolled in SFIA. This is the way that the program is currently being administered, so no taxpayers would be impacted. Section 1 goes on to amend statute to clarify that land classified as 2C managed forest land cannot be enrolled in the SFIA program. This is a technical clarification because Minnesota statute already defines 2C land as land that is not enrolled in SFIA. So this, again, Mr. Chair, is just updating statute to clarify it and would impact no taxpayers. It also adds a provision that a minimum of 3 acres must be included from enrolled land when the land is improved with the structure. This is how it's currently administered, and again, Mr. Chair, this would impact no taxpayers, but it would clarify within the law so that as people are reading about the program, they would see that plainly. Section 2 adds a new section to statute to require that on the request of the Commissioner of Revenue, the Commissioner of Natural Resources must verify that claimants have forest management plans on file with the Department of Natural Resources. I just wanted to note, Mr. Chair, that if any further action is required by the Department of Natural Resources in reviewing or auditing these forest management plans, I know that they will be asking for additional appropriations, but that is not what this bill is doing. Section 3 amends statute by adding a subdivision to require the Department of Natural Resources to certify the number of watercraft launches and trailer parking spaces in each county for the purposes of administering the Aquatic Invasive Species Program. The department already uses the Department of Natural Resources list to determine this number. This would just state it in statute. After the aid program was enacted, it was natural for us, for the Department of Revenue, to go to the Department of Natural Resources to ask for this information. But there were some counties that said, you know, we have a different number of boat launches. And we told them to go talk to the DNR, so we wanted to make sure in statute it was clarified what lists we were using for that purpose. Section 4 amends statute by adding a subdivision to require the Department of Natural Resources certify to the Department of Revenue the counties that have complied with their requirement to establish guidelines for addressing aquatic invasive species. This provision is effective for PAIDs payable in 2016 and thereafter. The certification will not be difficult, but it is needed as a starting place to pay out the aid. Currently, there are some counties that aren't even requesting the aid, but they are receiving the aid under statute. So this would, if they don't submit a plan, then they would not receive any aid. And then Section 5 repeals some statutory language that contains an obsolete formula for calculating SFIA payments. You know, before 2010, there was a complicated formula for SFIA. Now it is $7 an acre. So the formula in statute is no longer used, and likely if there was a new formula for SFIA, we would not be reverting back to that formula. So this is just removing that. This is something that was suggested in the unsession and then was not enacted in the end. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I think the next stop for this provision is the Tax Committee. And as session moves along, if anyone has any questions, feel free to stop and ask.
Thank you, Mr. Cummins. Questions for the author or Mr. Cummins? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably for Mr. Cummins, I'm not exactly sure, but on page 3 of the bill, were you talking about the certification at the county level and so forth? Then you also said that there would be a requirement for submitting a plan. I'm wondering what are the guidelines for, are there going to be some guidelines that are drawn up so that the counties have an idea, or is it kind of a carte blanche plan? And then what would be the mechanism for some sort of approval or rejection of the plan?
Mr. Cummins.
Mr. Chair, there under current law, there really are no guidelines or approval process for the plan. So they just must submit a plan. And so the plans, there's no consistency or level of detail related to those plans. I think the intention was just to ensure that the counties had the ability to say what they were going to do with it. But they did not ask for greater detail in terms of that. So in terms of the certification is whether they submitted it or not, not what it looked like.
Thank you. Additional questions, Representative Fabian? Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Hansen.
It's a good bill.
Good. Any other questions? Representative Torkelson, you want to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like
to I'm sorry. Representative Torkelson, anybody in the audience, SFIA here, any questions? Anybody want to speak for or against? They're nodding no. Anyone want to speak to this bill? Representative Torkelson, you want to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1931 be referred to the Tax Committee.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment's adopted. It's on to taxes. Members, we're done until Tuesday. See you then. We're adjourned.